Chapter 20. There is a moral sense, and there is an immoral sense. History shows us that the moral sense enables us to perceive morality and how to avoid it, and that the immoral sense enables us to perceive immorality and how to enjoy it. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. Melbourne spreads around over an immense area of ground. It is a stately city architecturally as well as in magnitude. It has an elaborate system of cable car service. It has museums, and colleges, and schools, and public gardens, and electricity, and gas, and libraries, and theaters, and mining centers, and wool centers of the arts and sciences, and boards of trade, and ships, and railroads, and a harbor, and social clubs, and journalistic clubs, and racing clubs, and a squatter club sumptuously housed and appointed, and as many churches and banks as can make a living. In a word, it is equipped with everything that goes to make the modern great city. It is the largest city of Australasia, and fills the post with honor and credit. It has one specialty. This must not be jumbled in with those other things. It is the mitred metropolitan of the horse racing cult. Its race ground is the Mecca of Australasia. On the great annual day of sacrifice, the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Day business is suspended over a stretch of land and sea as wide as from New York to San Francisco, and deeper than from the Northern Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico. And every man and woman, of high degree or low, who can afford the expense, put away their other duties and come. They begin to swarm in by ship and rail a fortnight before the day, and they swarm thicker and thicker day after day, until all the vehicles of transportation are taxed to their uttermost, to meet the demands of the occasion, and all hotels and lodgings are bulging outward, because of the pressure from within. They come 100,000 strong, as all the best authorities say, and they pack the spacious grounds and grandstands and make a spectacle such as is never to be seen in Australasia elsewhere. It is the Elbourne Cup that brings this multitude together. Their clothes have been ordered long ago, at unlimited cost, and without bounds, as to beauty and magnificence, and have been kept in concealment until now, for unto this day are they consecrate. I am speaking of the ladies' clothes, but one might know that. And so the grandstands make a brilliant and wonderful spectacle, a delirium of color, a vision of beauty. The champagne flows, everybody is vivacious, excited, happy, everybody bets, and gloves and fortunes change hands right along, all the time. Day after day the races go on, and the fun and the excitement are kept at white heat, and when each day is done, the people dance all night so as to be fresh for the race in the morning. And at the end of the great week the swarms secure lodgings and transportation for next year, then flock away to their remote homes and count their gains and losses, and order next year's cup clothes, and then lie down and sleep 2 weeks, and get up sorry to reflect that a whole year must be put in somehow or other before they can be wholly happy again. The Melbourne Cup is the Australasian National Day. It would be difficult to overstate its importance. It overshadows all other holidays and specialized days, of whatever sort in that congeries of colonies. Overshadows them? I might almost say it blots them out. Each of them gets attention, but not everybody's. Each of them evokes interest, but not everybody's. Each of them rouses enthusiasm, but not everybody's. In each case, a part of the attention, interest, and enthusiasm is a matter of habit and custom, and another part of it is official and perfunctory. Cup Day, and Cup Day only, commands an attention, an interest, and an enthusiasm which are universal and spontaneous, not perfunctory. Cup Day is supreme, it has no rival. I can call to mind no specialized annual day, in any country, which can be named by that large name supreme. I can call to mind no specialized annual day in any country whose approach fires the whole land with a conflagration of conversation and preparation and anticipation and jubilation. No day save this one, but this one does it. In America we have no annual supreme day, no day whose approach makes the whole nation glad. We have the 4th of July, and Christmas, and Thanksgiving. Neither of them can claim the primacy, neither of them can arouse an enthusiasm which comes near to being universal. 8 grown Americans out of 10 dread the coming of the 4th, with its pandemonium and its perils, and they rejoice when it is gone, if still alive. The approach of Christmas brings harassment and dread to many excellent people. They have to buy a cartload of presents, and they never know what to buy to hit the various tastes. They put in 3 weeks of hard and anxious work, and when Christmas morning comes they are so dissatisfied with the result, and so disappointed, that they want to sit down and cry. Then they give thanks that Christmas comes, but once a year. The observance of Thanksgiving Day as a function has become general of late years. The thankfulness is not so general. This is natural. 2/3 of the nation have always had hard luck and a hard time during the year, and this has a calming effect upon their enthusiasm. We have a supreme day, a sweeping and tremendous and tumultuous day, a day which commands an absolute universality of interest and excitement. But it is not annual. It comes but once in 4 years. Therefore it cannot count as a rival of the Melbourne Cup. In Great Britain and Ireland they have 2 great days, Christmas and the Queen's birthday. But they are equally popular. There is no supremacy. I think it must be conceded that the position of the Australasian day is unique, solitary, unfellowed, and likely to hold that high place a long time. The next things which interest us when we travel are, first, the people, next, the novelties, and finally the history of the places and countries visited. Novelties are rare in cities which represent the most advanced civilization of the modern day. When one is familiar with such cities, in the other parts of the world he is in effect familiar with the cities of Australasia. The outside aspects will furnish little that is new. There will be new names, but the things which they represent will sometimes be found to be less new than their names. There may be shades of difference, but these can easily be too fine for detection by the incompetent eye of the passing stranger. In the larrikin he will not be able to discover a new species, but only an old one met elsewhere, and variously called loafer, rough, tough, bummer, or blatherskite according to his geographical distribution. The larrikin differs by a shade from those others, in that he is more sociable toward the stranger than they, more kindly disposed, more hospitable, more hearty, more friendly. At least it seemed so to me, and I had opportunity to observe. In Sydney, at least. In Melbourne I had to drive to and from the lecture theatre, but in Sydney I was able to walk both ways, and did it. Every night, on my way home at 10, or a quarter past, I found the larrikin grouped in considerable force at several of the street corners, and he always gave me this pleasant salutation. "Hello, Mark. Here's to you, old chap. Say, Mark. Is he dead?" A reference to a passage in some book of mine, though I did not detect, at that time, that that was its source. And I didn't detect it afterward in Melbourne, when I came on the stage for the first time, and the same question was dropped down upon me from the dizzy height of the gallery. It is always difficult to answer a sudden inquiry like that, when you have come unprepared, and don't know what it means. I will remark here, if it is not an indecorum, that the welcome which an American lecturer gets from a British colonial audience is a thing which will move him to his deepest deeps, and veil his sight and break his voice. And from Winnipeg to Africa, experience will teach him nothing. He will never learn to expect it. It will catch him as a surprise each time. The war cloud hanging black over England and America made no trouble for me. I was a prospective prisoner of war, but at dinners, suppers, on the platform, and elsewhere, there was never anything to remind me of it. This was hospitality of the right metal, and would have been prominently lacking in some countries, in the circumstances. And speaking of the war flurry, it seemed to me to bring to light the unexpected, in a detail or two. It seemed to relegate the war talk to the politicians on both sides of the water, whereas whenever a prospective war between two nations had been in the air theretofore, the public had done most of the talking and the bitterest. The attitude of the newspapers was new also. I speak of those of Australasia and India, for I had access to those only. They treated the subject argumentatively and with dignity, not with spite and anger. That was a new spirit too, and not learned of the French and German press, either before Sedan or since. I heard many public speeches, and they reflected the moderation of the journals. The outlook is that the English-speaking race will dominate the earth 100 years from now, if its sections do not get to fighting each other. It would be a pity to spoil that prospect by baffling and retarding wars, when arbitration would settle their differences so much better, and also so much more definitely. No, as I have suggested, novelties are rare in the great capitals of modern times. Even the wool exchange in Melbourne could not be told from the familiar stock exchange of other countries. Wool brokers are just like stockbrokers. They all bounce from their seats and put up their hands and yell in unison, "No stranger can tell what," and the president calmly says, "Old to Smith and Company, 3d farthing next," when probably nothing of the kind happened. For how should he know? In the museums you will find acres of the most strange and fascinating things. But all museums are fascinating, and they do so tire your eyes, and break your back, and burn out your vitalities with their consuming interest. You always say you will never go again, but you do go. The palaces of the rich, in Melbourne, are much like the palaces of the rich in America, and the life in them is the same, but there the resemblance ends. The grounds surrounding the American palace are not often large, and not often beautiful, but in the Melbourne case the grounds are often deucedly spacious, and the climate and the gardeners together make them as beautiful as a dream. It is said that some of the country seats have grounds, domains about them which rival in charm and magnitude those which surround the country mansion of an English lord. But I was not out in the country, I had my hands full in town. And what was the origin of this majestic city, and its efflorescence of palatial townhouses and country seats? Its first brick was laid, and its first house built by a passing convict. Australian history is almost always picturesque. Indeed, it is so curious and strange that it is itself the chiefest novelty the country has to offer, and so it pushes the other novelties into second and third place. It does not read like history, but like the most beautiful lies. And all of a fresh new sort, no moldy old stale ones. It is full of surprises, and adventures, and incongruities, and contradictions, and incredibilities. But they are all true, they all happened. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.